I want to be a part of the Europe and I want freedom as my other friends do. But this law just gets us more far from that mission.
Why Georgians are protesting and why they're worried about Russian influence. For Sunday, May 5th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, an interview with NASA Administrator Bill Nelson about the agency's ambitious goals for the next few years.
The goal is to go to the moon to learn so we can go farther, to Mars and beyond.
We'll also hear how the Israel-Hamas war is covered by the Israeli and Palestinian media. We'll talk about a quirky new reality TV show focused on Zillow. And we'll play a card game with comedian Jenny Slate.
It's not relevant whether or not you think my butt is there. I know it's there. My toilet knows it's there. And unfortunately, some of my friends know it's there.
That and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Israeli military says it's closed one of the border crossings where humanitarian aid moves into Gaza amid rocket fire from militants inside. Local media reports say a number of people have been injured. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more.
The Kerem Shalom border crossing between Israel and southern Gaza is where U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken inspected aid deliveries last week. The Israeli military says air raid sirens went off there today after militants launched rockets from nearby Rafah, where more than a million Palestinians have sought refuge. Hamas's military wing says it was targeting Israeli army barracks, not aid. The border closure means food and medicine deliveries are held up at a time when the UN's World Food Program director says all-out famine is underway. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas's leader Ismail Haniyeh have both issued statements blaming the other for their failure to agree on a ceasefire plan. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
And protests against Israel's war in Gaza continue at U.S. campuses, including the University of Texas in Austin. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has more.
Disclose! Divest! We will not stop! We will not rest!
At UT Austin, protests started 2 weeks ago on one of the main entrances to the university. Since then, more than 100 people have been arrested, and the majority have been charged with criminal trespass. Their demands mirror those of thousands of students in colleges across the country. They want Israel's war in Gaza to stop and their universities to divest from businesses with ties to Israel. Amer Kadumi is an undergrad at UT Austin. He was arrested recently, although his charges were dropped.
We will continue to advocate for Palestine until their suffering is ended.
The university says they'll consider disciplinary actions for students arrested during the on-campus pro-Palestinian protests. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
After a bit of a roller coaster ride in stock markets last week, investors will determine whether the recent rally can continue. NPR's Rafael Nam has a preview of the week ahead.
Stocks ended last week on a strong note. A report showing employers hired fewer workers than expected in April raised hopes the Federal Reserve could start cutting interest rates sooner rather than later. A slowing labor market may sound like a bad thing, but it could help the economy if it cools down inflation, which is not coming down as fast as the Fed would like. A handful of senior Fed policymakers will be speaking this week, and investors will pay close attention. Investors will also closely follow earnings results, including from Walt Disney and Uber. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm John Carpilio in Boston. At the Northeastern University commencement for undergraduates, the student speaker raised the issue of Israel's war against Hamas. This afternoon's ceremony comes a week after protesters on campus were arrested for not taking down their pro-Palestinian tent encampment. Rebecca Bamadine addressed the civilian casualties in Gaza.
And the lives of these mothers in Gaza and the entire population remain at risk every day that remains without a permanent ceasefire in Gaza.
Congresswoman Lori Trahan says she supports the peaceful nationwide protests on college campuses that support Palestinians, but Trahan tells WCVB's On the Record some of the demonstrations have crossed the line.
We have seen instances where that protest has been weaponized against Jewish students. It's been calling for the mass killing of Jews who support Israel. We've seen destruction of property meant to intimidate people who don't agree with them.
Trahan is calling for a ceasefire in the conflict. Flags flown at half-staff today to honor firefighters who lost their lives in the line of duty. A national tribute taking place in Maryland this weekend honors firefighters, including lieutenants from the Boston and Winchester Fire Departments. Both died from firefighting-related cancers. The Celtics will play the Cleveland Cavaliers in the second round of the playoffs. The Cavs beat the Orlando Magic this afternoon. The Celtics will host the first of the seven-game series on Tuesday night at the TD Garden. And at last check, the Red Sox were leading the Minnesota Twins in the ninth inning by a score of 9-2. Showers, patchy fog, upper 40s overnight, partly sunny, threat of showers, highs in the low 70s tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Annie E. Casey Foundation, using research and evidence to develop solutions that help families and communities create a brighter future for young people. More information is available at aecf.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. In an ongoing war, information is often viewed as an important weapon. Information about what the other side is doing, but also what the people in a country and war see and know about the conflict. This is the sound of a video clip from Al Jazeera English, posted earlier today on the social media platform X.
If you're watching this pre-recorded report, then Al Jazeera has been banned in the territory of Israel.
Israel has banned the Qatari news channel from its airwaves and online in the country, saying its coverage of the war in Gaza threatens national security. The move comes as critics accuse both Israeli and Palestinian media of failing to cover the suffering on the other side of the conflict. And each side is quick to discredit the other's point of view. NPR's Carrie Kahn talked with news consumers and journalists on both sides of the ongoing war and brings us this report.
At a convenience store in Tel Aviv's working-class Hatikva neighborhood, a group of men are filling out lottery tickets, smoking cigarettes, and occasionally glancing up at the TV playing the evening news. Shachaf Simantov, a 20-year-old driver for a food delivery app, says he gets almost all his news from TV.
What happened in my country, I see. What I need to see, I see. Hamas, Gaza, fake news.
He doesn't believe people are going hungry in Gaza or the high Palestinian death toll, more than 34,000, according to the health ministry, which Israelis emphasize is run by Hamas. The TV is set to Channel 14, which was launched 10 years ago and is now Israel's number two station. With its steady stream of conservative and favorable coverage of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it's been dubbed Israel's Fox News. Alon Harazi is 44 years old. He works for a moving company. He says he likes Channel 14 stories about Israel's military, which he says motivates young people to join the army. Most Israeli TV coverage focuses on soldier profiles and Hamas's brutal attack on Israel on October 7th that killed about 1,200 people, according to Israel. There are also frequent updates on the more than 100 hostages still held in Gaza and their relatives' agonizing wait for their release. However, Ruti Poltil, a 63-year-old retiree, says she seldom sees what's happening to the people of Gaza on Israeli TV. She watches TikTok. It breaks my heart to see their destroyed hospitals, all the children without fathers, mothers crying, she says. Across the street at a small hair salon, 33-year-old Shlomi Racamino is getting his weekly trim. Channel 14 is also on the TV above his chair. He says he has no need to watch anything else.
We don't need to see anyone in Gaza. We need to erase them all.
Almost half of Israelis over the age of 20 watch TV news, and almost a fifth say they'll only watch Channel 14, says Tehilia Schwartz-Altschuler, a media expert at the Israel Democracy Institute.
Just like what happens in America these days, our media is very, very polarized.
And just like in other countries, she says Israeli media budgets have been slashed as advertisers shift to social media. At the same time, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues his campaign against critical media. He's facing criminal charges for allegedly giving favors to media tycoons to get better coverage. He denies any wrongdoing. Israelis are getting their news in a bubble, says Schwartz Altshuler.
And this creates crazy blind spots for the Israeli public, as well as a gap between the world's understanding of what is happening in the territories or in Gaza and the Israeli public's understanding.
Israelis view themselves as victims after October 7th and don't understand why the world sees them as the aggressors in this fight, says Meron Rapaport, an Israeli journalist. And they were stunned when accused of genocide in the International Court of Justice, he adds.
The Israeli public deserves that. At least you will get a wider picture of what's going on.
Rapaport, who works at the independent news site 972, says Israelis are being fed a steady diet of patriotism and victimhood. In the control room of Watan Television in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, a man directs a nightly call-in show. Palestinian media faces scrutiny too, like reporters calling Hamas militants resistance fighters. General Director Mo'ammar Arabi says Watan tries to cover both sides fairly.
All of us, we saw what's happening in the 7th of October when Hamas attacked, but today they're killing everything in Gaza. This is our children, our fathers, our mothers, so we need to highlight the suffering.
Watan's offices in Gaza were destroyed in an Israeli airstrike. At least 97 journalists have been killed in Gaza since October 7th, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Ramallah resident and avid news consumer, 38-year-old Mohammed Qassam Ali, says Palestinians know all they need to know about October 7th. He gets most of his news from Telegram and Al Jazeera, the Qatari-based news channel. We cannot forget which side is responsible for October 7th, he says. The international community and Israel has trapped Gaza for decades, leaving little hope, he adds. He doesn't believe what is on Israeli media. A recent poll by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey showed that 90% of Palestinians do not believe Hamas committed atrocities on October 7th. As Palestinian media continues to report what they view as an extreme and intolerable man-made humanitarian crisis, Israeli media presses its coverage of what it reflects as a just and existential fight for security and survival. Outside Tel Aviv in the makeup room at Channel 13 studios, Raviv Drucker, one of Israel's best-known investigative journalists, gets last-minute hairstyling. His weeknight news show is about to go live.
I need to go in.
Have a good show. He, too, criticizes Israeli media for not showing what is happening to Gaza's population. But he says journalists are people, too, and like society, they're traumatized by Hamas's vicious attack.
It's really easy to ask them to be, to aspire to the highest standards, but it's very difficult to implement.
He recently put an image of a Palestinian baby with blood on his face on his show and was criticized as being too provocative by panelists. Israel's public doesn't want to see that side of the story, he says, and most of Israeli journalism doesn't want to show it. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A series of protests has rocked the small former Soviet Republic of Georgia in recent weeks. At issue, a controversial draft bill winding its way through parliament that targets the country's civil society and that critics say reflects Kremlin influence. From the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Night after night, tens of thousands of Georgians have taken to the streets of Tbilisi to protest new legislation in parliament that they argue will determine the country's future. At stake is whether Georgia strengthens its ties to Europe or falls back under Russian influence, says university student Miriam Isayashvili.
I want to be a part of the Europe and I want freedom as my other friends do. But this law just gets us more far from that mission.
Introduced by the ruling Georgia Dream Party, the legislation would force non-governmental organizations and independent media that received more than 20% of their funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. More critically, opponents say the bill echoes a Russian law the Kremlin has used to crush its own civil society. That's prompted warnings from Western officials. The legislation's passage could derail Georgia's current bids to join Western clubs like the European Union and NATO, effectively pushing Georgia back into Moscow's orbit.
As Georgian politician and Georgian citizen, it is very much insulting when somebody puts Georgia and Russia on the same level.
Maka Bichordashvili is a Georgia Dream lawmaker who heads the Parliament's Committee on EU Integration. She rejects charges that the law is Russian-inspired, noting Russia remains Georgia's number one geopolitical foe after the Kremlin occupied parts of Georgian territory following a brief war in 2008. But Georgashvili says the new law is about transparency, keeping dark money and bad actors out of Georgian politics and nothing more.
I mean, knowing Georgian society and knowing our modern history, I would say that would be impossible for any government to use such a law against civil society.
Yet at a rally in favor of the legislation last week, Georgia Dream's founder and the country's richest man, Bidzina Ivanishvili, made a rare public speech in which he accused Western-backed NGOs of seeking to overthrow the government and provoke Georgia into another conflict with Russia, even as he guaranteed his country's EU membership by the end of the decade. Becca Kobahidze, a professor at Elia State University, who's been speaking out against the law, accuses Ivanishvili of undermining the European future the vast majority of Georgians want while parroting policies that please Moscow.
Even his supporters are supporters of European Union membership. And he must mention that, yeah, we also want to become part of the European Union whilst doing everything to sabotage this process.
That includes employing increasingly heavy-handed tactics against demonstrators. This week saw government riot troops use stun grenades, tear gas, water cannons, and rubber bullets against protesters, actions that have been criticized by top EU officials. Back at the pro-government rally, the crowd breaks out into one of Georgia's most beloved folk songs, Chukrulo. It's an ancient tale about heading off to battle to fight armies in faraway lands. Yet with Georgian society today divided and angry over a foreign agent law expected to pass later this month, the danger is the next battle may not be far away, but right at home. Charles Maines, NPR News, Tbilisi, Georgia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you're listening to 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon, I'm John Carpilio. Glad you're with us.
WBUR supporters include The Lyric Stage with The Drowsy Chaperone. A cast album from the jazz age comes to life with a self-admiring showgirl, her gin-soaked chaperone, and a cornucopia of memorable characters. This love letter to musical theater sparkles with mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. April 5th through May 12th, lyricstage.com.
Showers, patchy fog overnight, temps in the upper 40s.
WBUR supporters include Whale Jam, May 16th in Boston, a benefit concert to save the critically endangered North Atlantic white whale. Presented by Nantucket Crisps, the night features Matt Quinn from Mount Joy, The Head and the Hearts, Jonathan Russell, David Shaw from The Revivalists, and more. Tickets for Whale Jam at roadrunner.com.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Hamas says the latest talks in Cairo on a ceasefire in Gaza has ended. After recent signs of progress, the outlook appears to dim. This as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to invade Rafah in southern Gaza, where a million Palestinians are sheltering from the war, despite international criticism. Orthodox Christians are celebrating Easter today. For Ukrainians, it's their third since Russia launched a full-scale invasion. President Volodymyr Zelensky asked people to pray for the soldiers on the front line. And a new study shows hormone therapy is safe for women under the age of 60 to treat menopause symptoms. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
You're now watching live feed from Wenchang's Satellite Launch Center.
That's the sound of China's Chang'e 6 lifting off Friday, carrying a probe to the far side of the moon to gather samples and bring them back to Earth. If successful, it would be a first for any country.
It's now starting its epic journey to the moon.
The race to get astronauts back to the moon, it's also in full swing. And the U.S. has serious competition.
Soft landing on the moon. India is on the moon.
Last August, India successfully landed a spacecraft near the moon's south pole. Five nations in total have now landed spacecraft on the moon. This time around, the race isn't just about who gets there first. It's a race for resources, minerals, and maybe even water, which could fuel further space exploration.
And here we go.
If the U.S. stays on schedule, it would get humans back to the moon before anyone else as part of NASA's Artemis program. It's a big if, but NASA is making progress.
And liftoff of Artemis 1.
Artemis 1 launched in late 2022 and put an uncrewed Orion capsule in orbit around the moon. Artemis 2 will circle the moon with a crew.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Artemis 2 crew.
It was supposed to happen later this year, but got delayed until 2025. If that goes well, the U.S. will try to put humans back on the moon with Artemis 3. NASA is making a bit of a bet and mostly relying on private companies. In the 1960s, in the heat of the Cold War, budgets were flush.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Now, the U.S. is hoping that private contractors, mainly Elon Musk's SpaceX, can get Americans back on the moon for a fraction of the price. Earlier this year, two private American companies attempted to land uncrewed research spacecraft on the moon. One succeeded.
And liftoff. Go, SpaceX.
And one failed.
Astrobotics Peregrine Moonlander ended its mission in a fiery re-entry.
NASA has set its sight on a big goal, reaching the moon and then Mars. But with limited resources and facing a more crowded field, it's unclear if the U.S. will dominate space as it once did. This week, I went to NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. In the lobby, I touched a moon rock. It was collected by the crew of Apollo 17 in 1972, the last time humans stood on the moon. Then I went upstairs to Administrator Bill Nelson's office to talk to him about NASA's plans to return within the next few years.
The goal is not just to go back to the moon. The goal is to go to the moon to learn so we can go farther, to Mars and beyond. Now, it so happens that we're going to go to a different part of the moon. We're going to the South Pole, and that is attractive because we know there's ice there in the crevices of the rocks, in the constant shadow or darkness. And if, in fact, there's water, then we have rocket fuel. And we're sending a probe later this year that is going to dig down underneath the surface on the South Pole and see if there is water. But you go to the moon and you do all kind of new things mm-hmm. that you need in order to go all the way to the Mars. The moon is 4 days away. Mars, under conventional propulsion, is 7 or 8 months. So we're going back to the moon to learn a lot of things in order to be able to go further.
Lay out for me what the timeline is for Artemis right now, because this was the year that that first mission was supposed to take a crew to circle the moon. That's been delayed. What are we looking at right now?
Well, understand we don't fly until it's ready.
Yeah.
Because safety is paramount. But the plan is September of next year, 25, that the crew of four, three Americans and a Canadian, will circle the moon and check out the spacecraft. Then the contractual date with SpaceX a fixed price contract is 1 year later, September of 26. Now, as you know, SpaceX is just going through the getting their rocket up on, they're about to launch again this month with their huge rocket. It's got 33 Raptor engines in the tail of it. And then their actual spacecraft called Starship, they're going to try to get it to come on down. They just did a fuel transfer, by the way, on the last one, which is something that's very hard to do.
And it's key for these future missions.
And it's absolutely key, because they have to basically refuel in low Earth orbit before Starship goes on to the moon.
You said that nobody's going to go until they're ready. As you know, there were some reports. The Government Accountability Office had a report late last year raising serious concerns and skepticism about the timeline that you laid out. Do you share that concern? Do you feel like this timeline is realistic?
Well, all I can do is look to history. When we rush things, we get in trouble. And we don't want to go through that again. Mm-hmm. I was on the space shuttle 10 days before the Challenger explosion, and that is something you just don't want to go through. 17 astronauts have given their lives. Space flight is risky, especially going with new spacecraft and new hardware to a new destination. That's why this launch of the Boeing Starliner, it's a test flight. The two astronauts are test pilots. If everything works well, then the next one will be the starting of a cadence of four astronauts in the Starliner.
In the 60s and 70s, NASA's moonshot was a central organizing thrust of the U.S. government. The Apollo program cost about $25 billion at the time, the equivalent of a little less than $300 billion today. That's not the case for Artemis. Nelson argues NASA has done big things over and over in the decades since those stratospheric Apollo budgets. And a big part of the current calculation is relying on private companies, not the U.S. government, to get crews to the moon and beyond.
I do want to ask, though, SpaceX has had so much success when it comes to space flight, but Elon Musk's decision-making has come under a lot of scrutiny in recent years when it comes to some of his other companies, Twitter and Tesla. His kind of engagement in culture war politics. Any concern that so much of this plan is in the hands of Elon Musk at this point in time?
Elon Musk has one of the most important decisions he made, as a matter of fact, is he picked a president named Gwynne Shotwell. She runs SpaceX. She is excellent. And so I have no concerns.
No concerns. When you were on the Hill the other day, a lot of the questions came back to China. And in speeches you have given, you keep coming back to China as well. What is the concern about, you know, we just had a report on our show. One of our reporters watched one of these launches in person and was reporting on just how focused China is to get back to the moon as well. Why is it key to you? Why does it matter so much that the U.S. Beat China back to the moon?
Well, first of all, I don't give a lot of speeches about China, but people ask a lot of questions about China. And it's important simply because I know what China has done on the face of the earth. For example, with the Spratly Islands, they suddenly take over a part of the South China Sea and say, this is ours, you stay out. Now, I don't want them to get to the South Pole, which is a limited area that where we think the water is. It's pockmarked with craters. And so there are limited areas that you can land on the South Pole. I don't want them to get there and say, this is ours, you stay out. It ought to be for the international community, for scientific research. So that's why I think it's important for us to get there first.
The U.S. is part of a lot of different treaties in terms of, you know, sharing its work with other countries. I guess people in China might hear that and say, well, we're concerned the U.S. would do the same.
Well, but we are the instigators with the international community, now upwards of 40 nations, and that will rise of the Artemis Accords, which are a common sense declarations about the peaceful use of space, mm-hmm. which includes working with others, which includes going to somebody else's rescue, having common elements so that you could in space, and a vast diversity of nations have now signed the accords, but China and Russia have not.
You said, I don't give a lot of speeches about China, but I'm asked about it a lot. This is being framed in those same space race terms in many ways, the U.S. versus China. Is that how you see it? Is that how you think about it?
With regard to going to the moon?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's specifically about making sure that those resources around the South Pole are protected.
And the peaceful uses for all peoples. That's basically the whole understanding of the space treaty that goes back decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
It is another iteration of the Declaration of the Peaceful Uses of Space.
How else can the U.S. ensure that other than getting there first?
Well, you know, we've got a lot of partners. And the partners generally, nations that get along with China as well. Nations that get along with Russia. By the way, we get along with Russia. Look, ever since 1975 in civilian space, we have been cooperating with Russia in space.
And that's continued throughout the Ukraine war in space.
Without a hitch.
So in China, how do you balance the speed and urgency and concern that you feel with the safety element that we talked about before, because both are very important to you?
We don't fly until it's ready. That's it.
And the last question I had on China is, when you were on the Hill the other day, a lot of the questions had to do with resources, but also concern that China might be viewing lunar activity through a military prism. Do you share that concern?
I do.
Can you tell us what specifically you're concerned about?
Well, I think if you look at their space program, most of it has some connection to their military.
What's the solution to that then from the U.S.'s perspective and NASA's perspective?
Well, take history. In the middle of the Cold War, two nations realized they could annihilate each other with their nuclear weapons. So was there something of high technology that the two nations, Russia, in this case the Soviet Union, and America could do? And an Apollo spacecraft rendezvoused and docked with a Soviet Soyuz, and the crews lived together in space. And the crews became good friends. Now that says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what history teaches us, that we can overcome. I would like for that to happen with China. But the Chinese government has been very secretive in their space program, their so-called civilian space program.
You've cared about all of this stuff for a long time. You represented Florida in the Senate. You flew on the space shuttle, as you mentioned. Now you're in charge of NASA. What is your goal for when you leave NASA? Where do you want the agency to be on all of these ambitious projects?
Well, understand that this is a group of wizards, and I just am privileged to tag along with them. I try to give them some direction, particularly with the interface of the government. I will be very happy if NASA, because of some little minor contribution that I might have made, will send our star sailors sailing on a cosmic sea to far-off cosmic shores.
Administrator Bill Nelson, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
NASA's privatized push will face another big test Monday night. The long-delayed Boeing Starliner is scheduled to make its first crewed flight to carry two test pilots to the International Space Station and back. If successful, it will help cement the role of private companies in the space race. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Did you ever sit down to read a book, get a half page into it, and realize that absolutely nothing has sunk in? Or maybe you finished a book the other day, and when it came up at a party, you realized, wow, I don't remember anything about this. Even under the best of circumstances, deep reading is hard, and it's even harder once you throw in a device in your pocket that is constantly clamoring for attention. But if you want to get better at it, our Life Kit team put together this guide on reading deeper. Here's NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Marianne Wolfe has written a number of books about the science of reading. Her latest is Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And she's a big advocate of deep reading, which means what exactly?
At the heart of it is the point where we, the reader, go beyond the wisdom of the author to discover our own.
Wolfe says it is something that we've all done to a certain extent, you know, get completely immersed in a text, bring our own thoughts and opinions to it. But it's hard to do, particularly if you do most of your reading on a screen.
The screen itself is a source of attention disruption. And by that, I mean we have so much information that we have a built-in defense mechanism. We skim.
And skimming is the enemy of deep reading. So if you really want to read deeply, step away from the screen and give print a shot. This doesn't have to be just for books. You know, Wolf prints out articles she needs for work or contracts she needs to comb over. And if you're out of practice deep reading, it's going to take time and discipline to get it back. A few years ago, Wolf tried to reread a Hermann Hesse book she once loved and found that she just couldn't lock in.
I was very stubborn. My mind was almost protesting stubbornly, I don't want to read this.
Also, for listeners, in your book, there's a funny moment where you're like, maybe this book is just bad.
Exactly. Yeah. You are so right. I mean, that was a piece of it. I was stubbornly rejecting the book and thinking, you know, I hate to say it on NPR, but I said, who in the world gave him a Nobel Prize for this? You know?
Wolf says it was as if she was fighting against her own inclination to skim. So the answer was to slow down.
For 2 weeks, I forced myself to read 20 minutes a day to try to be that older version of a reader. Each of us, if we're serious, can ferret 20 minutes of our day away and try to read at the pace of the book. And different books demand different paces.
Wolf says don't be too concerned with the rate of books you're reading. We're looking for quality over quantity here. As for remembering the things you read, Wolf says if you're deep reading, your mind has a way of storing that information, even if it feels like it's beyond your recollection.
There is more memory that consolidates than we have immediate perceptible access to. On the other hand, when we skim, we consolidate less.
But to really savor something you read and help encase a quote or thought or idea in your memory, write it down.
I write on the margin, and then I write in the back of the book the pages of the most important insights for me.
Obviously, only do this for books you own. Do not start defacing library books, please. That wouldn't help anybody deep read. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to 90.9 WBUR. Good evening. I'm John Carpilio. Coming up next at 6 o'clock, the New Yorker Radio Hour.
WBUR supporters include The Huntington with Toni Stone, Play Ball. The remarkable true story of the first woman to play professional baseball on a man's team, shattering expectations and setting her own rules. Lydia R. Diamond's script is filled with humor and love of the game. Opening May 17th at the Huntington Theater. HuntingtonTheater.org.
Pro-Palestinian encampments and demonstrations continuing at dozens of college campuses across the U.S. and around Boston. Keep listening to 90.9 WBUR for updates on the protests and the tensions fueling them.
And Native Plant Trust's Garden in the Woods in Framingham, showcasing the beauty of New England's native plants in a dramatic, natural landscape. Information at nativeplanttrust.org.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel is closing the offices of Qatar's Al Jazeera satellite news network, accusing it of being a mouthpiece for Hamas during the war in Gaza. The network calls the move slanderous and deceptive. The Houston area remains under flood watches and warnings today, and more rain is forecast. This as several rivers are at flood stage in the state. Hundreds of people and their pets have been rescued from rooftops and flooded roads. And after years of delays and stumbles, Boeing plans to launch astronauts to the International Space Station for NASA tomorrow night from Florida. SpaceX has already sent several taxis to the station with astronauts on board, but this will be Boeing's first. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Fantasy scrolling through real estate listings has become a popular American pastime in recent years. So popular, in fact, that Zillow Gone Wild, an account on Instagram, TikTok, and other social media platforms, has now been spun off into an equally wild reality TV series. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports.
Zillow Gone Wild is a place to go on social media if you're in the market for, say, a home in Kansas City, Missouri that's shaped like a UFO.
Because you see this spot, it's perfect for spaceship parking.
A Frank Lloyd Wright-designed residence in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
It was designed to blend into nature with its horizontal lines, vaulted ceilings, and cantilevered roofs.
Or a recently built cruise ship with close to 3,000 bedrooms.
Waking up to an ocean view in the actual ocean is the new best way to wake up.
Samir Mizrahi is Zillow Gone Wild's deadpan creator. The former social media director at BuzzFeed says he started the account on Instagram as a side project in the fall of 2020, and it grew from there.
Like prime pandemic, everyone's working from home, people are moving, companies are saying you can live wherever you want.
It was a time when people were thinking about their living spaces a lot, whether scanning real estate websites like Zillow in order to buy a new home, or, as was the case for Mizrahi, browsing just for kicks.
Like a board on your phone thing?
Mizrahi says many real estate social media influencers focus on specific niches like luxury mansions, mid-century moderns, or fixer-uppers. But Zillow Gone Wild is about defying everyday expectations.
It has to be something we've pretty much never seen before.
The same goes for the new 9-episode Zillow Gone Wild HGTV series, which Mizrahi executive produced. The first episode sets the tone.
I bought this Mr. Silo because I figured this was the coolest thing that I could possibly do, and me and my friends had a blast renovating it.
Seller Andrew Flair shows off his converted U.S. military missile launch facility in York, Nebraska. It has very thick steel doors and no windows.
It's all underground, covered in concrete, and if for some reason bomb goes off, you'll be safe.
Hosted by comedian Jack McBrayer, who viewers might recognize as Kenneth from 30 Rock, the show features 24 homes from around the country, either up for sale or recently sold. But only one of them will be crowned the country's wildest at the end of the series. The judging criteria include creativity, commitment to a concept or theme, and a quality McBrayer describes as wackadoo.
What's that special thing that sets this property apart? We reward impracticality.
That impracticality is what makes Zillow Gone Wild so compelling on TikTok and TV. But when it comes to actually selling a property, non-traditional architecture and home decor aren't necessarily virtues. So says Rhea Cotton.
As a real estate broker, you kind of get nervous about that because the resale value is not the greatest when you're making it your own. It may not be liked by other people.
But the San Francisco Bay Area-based realtor adds the popularity of Zillow Gone Wild on social media shows there's a growing appetite among homebuyers and wannabe homebuyers for the wackadoo.
I think more and more people are kind of bored of the cookie cutter way of doing things.
Case in point, the unusual music-themed home in Berkeley, California, that Cotton helped Zillow Gone Wild homeowner Adante Poynter buy.
Welcome to the saxophone house.
The home's facade is dominated by two massive gold saxophone-shaped columns. On episode 4 of the TV series, Poynter proudly shows off the gold treble clef ornaments on the balcony railings indoors.
I am an attorney, and oftentimes people come to me to make a statement on their behalf. When you look at the outside of this home, it's definitely a statement piece.
If Zillow Gone Wild demonstrates anything, it's that even the wildest of homes will find a buyer. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
When you're talking with somebody for the first time, usually you have to wait a little bit before you get to the real stuff. So you talk about the weather or sports or your kids or whatever, and then once you've established some trust, you can venture into deeper waters. Like a vivid dream that's always stayed with them, or a different career path they wish they had taken, or maybe their definition of God. Well, my colleague Rachel Martin has come up with a shortcut to get to the real parts of a conversation quicker.
Pick a card, 1 through 3.
On our new show, Rachel asks guests to choose questions at random, questions that go deep.
What's the biggest sacrifice you've ever made?
Rachel joins me now to talk about Wildcard, which is a brand new NPR podcast and will be a regular segment on this show. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you, Scott. I'm so happy to be here.
Last time we talked to you, you were winding down your Enlighten Me series.
Yep.
You were going to go away for a few months to develop a new thing. Mm-hmm. That new thing, I guess it's been developed.
It has been developed. It is here. As you said, it's called Wildcard. I'm really happy about it.
Tell me about the show.
Okay, so it's an interview game show. Right. And mm-hmm. It's based on this deck of cards. Each card has a really big, interesting question written on it. I hold 3 of these cards up at a time to my guest, and then they pick at random 1, 2, or 3. They can't see what the question is. So there's an element of chance, and it's sort of like choose your own adventure. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know where the conversation's going to go.
So I'm curious about where the format came from, because we were talking about the way that you were putting this new show together.
Yeah.
And then I checked in a little while later and suddenly it was a game. And I was I was very surprised by this development, but it seems to have worked well. When did that first pop into your head?
It was a lot of conversations, and we wanted to create a place that was fun, you know, where, yes, we could talk about these meaningful questions about how to navigate a life and how to be a good person and how our beliefs shape us and questions, big existential questions that we all have. And we wanted it to be playful at the same time. And I hope we do both. That was the intention, is to do both.
I see you've brought some cards with you, so we get a sense of what kind of questions
we're
talking about.
Yeah, you know. So I'll give you some examples, right? Here are a few of them. What do you admire about your teenage self? Do you have an immediate answer to that? Or are you gonna
Lately, I've been focusing on the things that embarrass me about my teenage self. But I think I was very idealistic and opinionated.
And
I was very, like, up in people's faces in a way that I'm not as an adult.
And you liked that.
There are some qualities to it that I wish I could bring back. There's some ways that I'm glad I'm a little more chill as an adult.
But I love that. I love that. Another one. This is a big one. Do you think there's order in the universe, or is it all chaos?
I think I'm very much order.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, and that's a question people have to sit and think, and you just had it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
Because otherwise we wouldn't be here. I feel like all of these things are spaced out in these crazy... I just did a whole interview on space, so I'm thinking about this.
Great.
I feel like the 1 in a trillion chance of all of these things clicking into place for, like, the earth to be here and atmosphere to be here and water to be here and then people to form, etc., and the way that we're all orbiting around black holes and going on and on again, like, that has to be ordered by some way. Or maybe I just don't want to deal with the world where it's not ordered.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
This is what I mean. Like, it's a shortcut to get to interesting, deeper places pretty fast.
Yeah. So I'm excited to hear some of the people that you've done this with. You've got Issa Rae, Chris Pine, Poet Laureate Ada Limon, but your first episode is with comedian Jenny Slate, who I love. We'll listen to that in a second, but why did you want Jenny Slate to play this game?
Oh, she is just the best. People might know her as the voice and creator of Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, or Mona Lisa Saperstein from Parks and Rec, and she is just hilarious, and she is also deeply introspective, and she is weird and wonderful. And I just knew that she could occupy this space really well.
All right, well, let's hear it.
Round 1. this is about memories, okay? We're looking back at the people, experiences, places that shaped you. I am holding three cards in my hand.
Wow, I'm nervous. Why?
Oh, God,
okay, whatever.
Don't be nervous. Don't be nervous. Okay, pick a card 1 through 3.
3. 3.
Oh, what's an ordinary place that feels extraordinary to you because of what happened there?
Oh, you know, this sounds really almost, I don't know, maybe gross or something. But I really feel that way about our bedroom in Massachusetts. And not because I'm like, you won't believe what what went down in here. But that my husband is someone who I met as a stranger. And I really felt that I would not see him again. I thought about him a lot, and I heard from another friend about where he lived in Massachusetts, and it felt to me that he lived almost in another dimension. The more I would hear about his personality, the more I just felt like, yeah, but I would never be able to be with someone like that. You know, they would never like me, and it just wouldn't work, and how would I get there and whatever. And I just remember the first time that I went to sleep in that bedroom and we were sleeping and I was like, wow, this is a real place. You know, like it's kind of like seeing the Eiffel Tower. And I just was like, I can't believe, like, it is real.
Wow. You had been married before, you were divorced. Did something have to change in you to make this relationship work? Or did it, was just like timing and he just met you at the right time?
I think it's all of those. Like, you know, my experience is that, unfortunately, you don't usually get to work on one issue at once. And I couldn't stop the timing of falling in love with him. And it was right for both of us to fall in love. And that was totally right on. But while walking down that path, I was very aware that I was injured. And yeah, like, I want to walk down this road with you, but will you be with me if I limp? And will you carry me if I just am, like, too tired? Or will you accept me for the state that I'm in if I promise that I really am working to heal and go forward?
Okay, we are moving on. Round 2, this is about insights. These are lessons that you're learning, things you're working on right now. 3 new cards. Pick a card 1 through 3.
2.
What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Wow. I guess dressing. Like, not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Love ranch. I love ranch. Dressing my body.
Dressing your body.
Yeah.
What is different about how you think of that?
I'm pleased to say that I've come through a fair amount of internalized misogyny. And like, so 10 years ago, I was 31. And it was like, you better wear that bikini. You better wear that bikini. You know, this just, this horrible, horrible, brutal feelings about my physical body and about how I needed to present, like what sexiness was and how much of my body to show and what it was like. And I've always had a pretty clear sense of actually what I find to be beautiful, but I feel like it was sort of muddled up. And now I just like kind of want to dress like Jane Goodall.
She has amazing style.
But like sometimes with a crop top. Yeah, I don't know. Like let it flow. I don't really know. But I'm just like, I just used to feel that I had to prove that like my butt was there. And now I'm like, it's not relevant whether or not you think my butt is there. I know it's there. My toilet knows it's there. And like my husband knows it's there. And unfortunately, some of my friends know it's there.
This is round 3. It's about beliefs, and this is our final round. So pick a card 1 through 3.
1.
Oh, I'm so glad this one came up. Is there anything in your life that has felt predestined?
I'm not sure. I don't really connect to the concept of destiny. I mean, and because I met my husband through, like, he really, I mean, I met him through friends. He's really a random person. Sometimes I get scared and I say to him, like, what if we hadn't met each other? What are the chances? And he always goes 100%. And I like that. And I don't know about the, like, soulmate thing, but I know, and it sounds so cheesy, but I do feel like I'm like, oh, he is my spiritual match. And I guess I believe in a spiritual eventuality, which you could call destiny, but that it doesn't, it's like a point on the globe, let's say. Like, it's like a point in your life cycle, a fixed point, but it doesn't mean that you'll get there. Like, you still have to do, you have to still do things to get there. It's an option. But I guess, no, I've never felt that anything was predestined. I've just felt as if every now and then it feels like there's kind of a meteor shower and, like, good fortune falls into my life like that. But that doesn't feel like, I just feels like it's random.
Yeah. Have you always been good about appreciating the meteor shower, or has that come later in life for you?
I think I actually have been. And I think that's because my mother, who I love dearly, will not be surprised to hear me say that I think sometimes her vernacular can be rather negative. If you ask her to tell a story, it often sounds like as if it were cloudy in the sky. Like, it's just like with this sort of tinge of dread and negativity. And it's like, it's kind of drama. It's drama. But I think, like, my response to that has been to be like, no, no, sunshine, no. And and it can also make me be like a terminal optimist in the worst way, like almost a fool. But I think I've always truly been keeping that kind of lookout. It's not a Pollyanna-ish thing. It's looking for light in the dark. That's what it is.
Jenny Slate, actress, writer, comedian. Her most recent special is called Seasoned Professional. It's streaming now on Prime Video, and it is so worth your time. And this has been the best time. Jenny Slate, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.